Well, it's exciting to be with you guys. This is my third NAB, and the fact that the sessions before the main NAB conference are getting more and more robust is really exciting for me. Just a quick C story, if you will, because while it's exciting for me to be here because of the topic, this audience is very important to me personally. My dad was National Association of Broadcast Engineers and Technicians. I grew up in a broadcast family. He was a cameraman for NBC for over 40 years. He won an Emmy for producing content for his live camera work on an evening with Fred Astaire. And he's in his 90s now. But one thing I can tell you for sure, that as he was filming Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and their complex routines of dance and broadcasting that live, he didn't take a second of that effort to think about the cybersecurity of that broadcast information. The thought that somebody would want to steal that broadcast, that somebody would want to maybe spoof it and change it in some way, the thought that somebody might want to jam that effort and deny access to that stream, was just not a thing in that so much of the entire history of content creation of broadcast and media. Today, we've got to worry about that. It's a real threat to your industry, it's a real threat to your business, and it's something that I'm sure this room is very focused on a daily basis. How do I protect today what generates the income for the companies that are in this business? Content is king, so let's protect the king. Next slide. Oh, sorry. See, I'm so used to just saying that and it just happens, and now I gotta do this on my own. It's hell to take the uniform off. So for the last 3 years, up until the change of administrations, I was the Chief of the Public Safety Homeland Security Bureau at the Federal Communications Commission. Real excited to see on the agenda today, you're gonna be having Cleet Johnson speak later on today. Cleet and I worked together at the FCC, and we were very focused on all of the five major pillars that make up the telecommunications space in our country, the wireless, wireline, cable, media, the public safety and security of that. It became clear to us that the changes that are underway in this space are just amazing. And you ain't seen nothing yet. The trajectory of what we're gonna see in the next couple of years is gonna be huge for the industry. Something that all the broadcasters will be focused on in the next couple of days is the new television standard, ATSC 3.0. We've got 5G that is being deployed now, and it ain't your mama's G. We're gonna be going from what was essentially a technology that was very focused on the phone to a technology that became focused on the smartphone. And now that technology is going to reach out to cities, and it will underpin what becomes smart cities. It will underpin a new engagement with media and content that is more interactive, but also starts to do things on our behalf before we even think about having a useful thing be done on our behalf by that content. And that will come from the sensors that make up the Internet of Things. That cloud technology is important to this as well, because the platforms that are going to make available the collection of this large repository of data that allows predictive calls to be made on that data set that are personal for us, for the individual consumer, will become possible in no small way by the cloud technology, by the ability to dynamically take the communications needed, the compute and the storage needed, and have that expand and contract to achieve these different functions. That's going to be coupled then with software-defined networking. So the appliances that we used to have in all of our network closets and in the different communication rooms in companies increasingly can be virtualized. Network functional virtualization, NFV, means that we can do routing in software. That will decrease costs for things that used to be hardware oriented. But when you think about it, the ability to create and then duplicate images for things that used to be hardware means that you can then rapidly scale in a way that we never thought before. And from a security standpoint, to bring maneuver, to bring the ability to dynamically change what your network looks like to an adversary, and coupling that with segmentation of the networks that will be a key part of how 5G works will really change the game from one that is now very much oriented towards the adversary having the upper hand to having a thinking defender with the ability to keep the adversary always guessing. And then what do we do with that, right? So the AI will bring that predictive technology to bear where we're going to be thinking about the decisions that are going to be made in this information space 6 months, a year ahead of time, because it's when the algorithms are written that really define how we're going to do that predictive decision in the future going forward. My daughter works for a major PR firm. She's the head of digital analytics, and it started out they didn't even have a digital analytics within this particular global PR firm. And increasingly, the brands would go to the company and say, hey, we want to place our ads in the content that people are actually watching, and it's not something you can just determine by the Nielsen ratings anymore. You can't just take 1,000 people with the button watching I Love Lucy and say, that's where I'm going to sell the most expensive content. Her challenge today is selling content to brands before content is even generated. And so they have to be predictive in that, and predictive in a way that's accurate enough to actually commoditize that and come up with a price that really makes sense in that AI world. Well, that's just one small snapshot of how AI is really changing your jobs, right? Because as you create content, you're competing with that real-time content that's of interest to people's eyeballs. We'll see more and more of that predictive aspect fueled by AI in how your companies are teeing up interesting content that will compete in the content landscape going forward. How that predictive piece is done, what it keys on from those large data sets, is attackable. You can change perceptions within that large content space, so we'll need to be thinking about that. Content now will include actions. And so robotics will be key here. And the rollout of 5G, some of the providers in really wanting to make it real brought an operation that occurred in the hospital with a doctor that was 1,000 miles away. 5G lowers latency, gets rid of jitter, and brings the ability to take something before the kind of tactile feel that you'd have in order to execute a complex operation, that can now be remoted. That's huge when we think of the medical challenges in our country, when we think of the kinds of things that we could do with the workforce that we increasingly want to have live where they want to live, but have results from their labor occur where the labor is where those actions are most effectively done. So it's an exciting world out there, and content is right in the middle of it. We went from analog to digital. This next step is the interactive step. So content anymore isn't going to be something that consumers just passively watch. They'll still be that. I mean, that won't go away. We'll still enjoy watching movies. But consumers will increasingly want to interact with that observation of content. They'll want to vote on who really should be the survivor on the island at the end of that show. They'll want to provide suggestions on what the ending for a drama or a soap opera will be. They'll want to engage politically in a way where they're teeing up the platform ideas for the particular candidates that they're rooting for. And there will be systems that make all this happen, right? This end user devices are rapidly changing. So smart TVs and radios, listen. Anybody have Alexa in their home or a Google device and have the situation where you're just carrying on a conversation with somebody in your house and suddenly your smart device thinks you want it to do something? I've had that several times now where the music starts and whoa. Hey, I wasn't talking to you. So there'll be more of that in our homes that will enhance the user experience with content, but will be a attackable surface. Advertisers can continue to micro-target their audience in a good way. People stop watching ads. Advertisers figured out, hey, if I create ads that people actually want to watch, they won't stop watching ads. So that's content. And the idea that an ad needs to be as entertaining and as interactive is an important thing, but also an attackable thing. Finally, the cross-platform aspect of this is an increasing challenge. So as we look at ATSC 3.0 and the broadcasters now, including hyperlinks in a broadcast, the path out from that broadcast with a hyperlink is over Wi-Fi and a smart device in a home that is provided by a different company. So we will also want to see content and have the same user experience, whether I'm watching my smart TV or whether I'm watching my smartphone on a trip to Vegas to attend a conference. That cross-platform aspect of how do you defend something that it's just not your company that we'll be delivering that content for is a challenge. Also, the concept of data portability. We've known for a decade or more when we went to cell phones that consumers wanted to be able to switch between one provider and another provider. I got tired of using AT&T. I'm going to use Verizon. I got tired of using Verizon. I want to use T-Mobile and back and forth to get the best deal. Well, the phone companies made it hard to do that by owning the numbers. And at the FCC, enough consumer input said, hey, stop. Consumers should own their own telephone numbers. So the FCC created the phone number portability rules that ensure that phone companies have to port your phone number over to the competitor when you want to switch, for whatever reason you want to switch. I expect in the next couple of years that we're going to see the same kind of consumer expectations begin to occur in the content world, in the content that they create. We will see data that now is a part of Facebook or is a part of Instagram or LinkedIn, that you decide that you want to change the platform that you're delivering your own data up in, and that we'll see some kind of mechanism to allow that data portability across the social media divide. So you may be asked as security professionals to help make sure that's meaningful, to help make sure that ability to port data, but at the same time secure the privacy associated with that becomes a thing. Content creators, obviously, Carol, a whole lot about copyright and intellectual property. It's really why this particular session started, was that concern over copyright. That won't go away, it is coming under more and more sophisticated attack. At the same time, though, that content consumers will increasingly need to be a part of your landscape as you look forward and think about what else am I going to have to protect. And there will be more sophisticated privacy expectations for the audience. My sweet spot, public safety. What's happening now in how our communities perceive threats and then act upon that knowledge is really exciting. It's benefiting from the deployment of sensors throughout communities. It will lead to smarter parking. That already I go to downtown DC, I have to worry about where a parking spot's gonna be open. I've got a list of choices and I can choose in the moment exactly what kind of parking arrangement I wanna have. Weather sensors, digital signage, acoustic sensors, shot spotters. Most major communities now have acoustic devices spread throughout the city where if a gunshot goes, they can, within seconds, determine the origin of that and the direction that bullet traveled. Just amazing, and that will increase. Water and gas metering, traffic lights controls, electrical vehicle charging, solar, security surveillance, and waste management, all just the tip of the iceberg and what we're going to see in the smart cities as we go forward. In general, we'll recognize hazardous situations sooner. It will allow us to initiate more effective mitigation. Think now about the ability to detect earthquakes. We have that ability 2 minutes, 3 minutes, depending on the length of the fault lines, to be able to know with a fair degree of certainty that an earthquake of significant magnitude is going to occur. Well, it's media that now, with the shake alerts, is gearing up to be ready to get that warning out in a tight enough timeline that will allow 60 seconds of preparatory activity by somebody that could, hey, maybe I'll leave this room and go outside, or maybe I'll go to a more protected area of the building. It's exciting to think about those kind of things in the more effective mitigation piece. Enhanced response, the ability to share that information about increased risk, about the situation around an area with first responders that will be using things like FirstNet and the ability to take not just a radio dispatch, but to get the picture and all of the history around a particular environment they're going into for that response. Exciting stuff. This will allow not only risk reduction actions, but the ability to triage after the event. So one of the things that the broadcast industry has done, they've developed a capability called AWARN. With AWARN now, broadcasters can send out not just the warning that the hurricane's coming, but send out a picture of all the evacuation routes. And links in that picture. Remember, this is over broadcast, so that if the individual who receives it on their smart TV or receives it on their smartphone can actually provide feedback on, are you seeing traffic congestion in the route that you're taking? After the actual storm comes through, are there injuries in your area? We can rapidly develop a heat map that will allow the triage of that resource need pairing that is so important to take the finite degree of first responders and make sure they're going to the most important areas of need after a major event. So all this great stuff, new functionality, that to an attacker is new attack surface. It's an expansion of the ways that if you've got malign intent, you can get into a network and generate a malicious activity. So that surface area now on the left-hand part of this, or the right-hand part of this picture, is no longer just, hey, I'm a broadcaster, I've got to keep my broadcast head on the air, I've got to fight against an attacker wanting to jam my signal or interfere it, and that's kind of the sum total of my concern. A couple of years ago, TV Monde 5 in France was attacked at the cable head because they had linked their content system with the back office IT for how they actually pay their employees and other kinds of activities. Didn't think in a million years that the one would be a content into taking the broadcast signal off the line, or even worse, injecting malicious content that would cause public to panic. This really leads to a big piece of this, which is it's a team sport going forward. The Dyne attack occurred a couple of years ago from a botnet called Mirai. The Mirai botnet took advantage of vulnerabilities in, of all things, baby monitors. Who knew that you needed to worry about the cybersecurity of a baby monitor? Well, attackers figured out that, hey, those things are shipped with default passwords. They are locked down in a way that ensures that the same vulnerability is going to occur in all of them. And they executed a malware called Mirai that first infected all of those baby monitors, I think tens of thousands of these things across the world. The first thing those that Mirai malware did, anyone want to take a guess? It improved the security of the device. It was so hard to get the botnet into the devices that, of course, you don't want to lose it. So it changed some of the things that, by default, access, passwords, those things, and ensured that now the botnet attacker owned those devices in a way that had persistence. Did he attack the consumers of the baby monitors? No, those weren't the individuals harmed. Nobody's going to now go shop for baby monitors that has a cyber seal of approval. People are going to buy it on Amazon or whatever your platform is for the lowest possible cost. That's how we buy these things and many IoT things in the future. The attack, the individual, the corporation that was harmed was the use of that botnet to create a denial of service attack at the domain name Resolver called Dyne, D-Y-N, that companies like eBay were using. And so eBay was taken offline for multiple hours because baby monitors were shipped in lousy cyber postures. So this is an interdependent, interconnected landscape as we go forward, that content over cable, content over satellite has known for some time, but now increasingly even the broadcasters over the air are now going to understand that this is an interconnected space, and you've got to be thinking as you go forward with partnerships with people before that you may have thought were your competitors and not exactly having the same interests of your company. Frenemies is a term that's often used. Well, the best industry vertical in the skill and the effectiveness and the pretty significant investment in cybersecurity has traditionally been fintech, the finance and banking. They agreed 10 years ago not to compete around who's the better defender, that it's not a market differentiate that they sought to, a market differentiate that they sought to exploit. That it was more important to make sure that people trusted banks, trusted credit cards. So let's get the competing companies to all work together to share information about cyber attacks. And they now do that in a very sophisticated way, machine to machine, real time. And they represent the most mature of the cybersecurity information sharing groups. So this group of representing the content, creators, content providers, ought to think about as you go forward, is it time to begin to increase your expectations for cybersecurity information sharing between competitors within the industry? As I work with companies, I tell them, many companies are just starting out. They can't envision investment in a full-blown cybersecurity program. And you don't have to do it all at once, but you need to begin somewhere. Start with hygiene. Just start getting the basics right. It used to be called the SAMS 20, is now the SIS 20. 20 different internal controls that you can begin to work on. Make sure that your supply chain, not only hardware supply chain, but where do you get your code? Is that secure? That you're beginning to have hygiene expectations for that supply chain. That you, at the same time, have a second prong that's looking at cybersecurity risk over the long haul. And this is what so many, even big companies, miss, is that you can't just hyper-focus on protect. You've got to think about the identify, protect, detect, respond, recover. It may be that your next best dollar put towards cybersecurity risk reduction isn't in protecting better. It may be it's in responding better or recovering in a way that actually enhances the value of your company and doesn't just take a brand hit because you were attacked. Finally, the third prong that people need to be thinking about is have a technology bias. It used to be that I would advise senior leaders, well, you don't want to be on the bleeding edge. That's where people die and fall off the tree. But increasingly, because the attackers are on the bleeding edge, that if you're not taking opportunities to leapfrog your architecture to the point that's taking advantage of some of these things that are cloud-based and the ability to create complete additional snapshots of your company's IT and OT landscape in a way that allows you to change it up regularly to frustrate an attacker, to bring an attacker into a walled-off area that you've just created that's fake. With the whole goal in mind of just getting the attacker to launch their weapons so you now not only know who's attacking you, but you know what kind of weapon he's going to use if he or she ever gets into the more juicy parts of your network. So maneuver, be a hard target. Create the opportunities to better understand your attacker and make cloud and SDN, these new technologies, work for you. Who decides what your cyber risk posture is going to be? Many companies I ask, and the CEOs will tell me, oh, it's the CISO, or it's the CTO. I'm here to tell you, no. It's somewhere between the CFO and the CEO. It's where you decide on how much you're going to invest in cybersecurity risk reduction. And too often, that's a binary discussion. Either give the CISO everything they asked, which never happens, or give them none of what they asked for, or give them something that's somewhat in between but really has no connection to anything rational. So companies need to begin, as they sophisticate their cyber security operations, to develop a common language where they can talk about cybersecurity risk with the people that need to rationalize investments for that company. To ensure that that common language allows cyber risk to be appreciated at the board level, so directors understand that, those decisions that are being made for the company. If the people charged with security for content spend 10-15% of their time helping the C-suite better understand the risk in this space, your jobs will become much easier because then it's a shared understanding of that risk and a shared ownership. Understand your gaps. Have a bias for that new technology. I'm not saying jump on everything that's new. There's still the bleeding edge, and you want to not bleed. But begin to include technology leaps in your toolkit for how you're addressing the cyber gaps. And finally, cultivate those information sharing networks. I want to close with a new attack vector that's an old attack vector. We always, in our country, in democracies, since democracy started in time, have benefited from the concept of the public square. The ability for the thinkers of the day to come together and share opposing views, to debate the issues of the day, that's really how democracies work. We have seen over the last 10, 20 years that concept of a public square has really become a virtual public square. We fewer and fewer engagements in how we decide about things politically, socially, what's right for our communities, that is done less and less in a physical space and more in the virtual space. Cyber attackers around the world understand this. A couple years ago, we were just defending around confidentiality, integrity, availability. There's a fourth area now, and it's the cognitive space. And if a cyber attacker can't get in to change your perception of confidentiality, integrity, and availability, hey, you're doing your job. Let me just change that cognitive perception of what reality is, and I'll be able to achieve the effects I want to achieve in that same space. So we're certainly seeing that play out in the debate around elections in our country and about the influence of Russia and other countries that want to change an outcome politically. This also happens in business, in your business. So I ask you, who's covering down on cognitive risks for your company? I'd encourage you to think about, as you develop more sophisticated ways to address cybersecurity risk, that you include the cognitive aspects, the cognitive threats in that risk landscape. And let's recapture the virtual public square. What you're doing isn't something that's just kind of cool so we can watch better shows and be better entertained. It's central to the continued existence of an effective functional democracy in our country. So I want to tell you that while I spent my entire career in uniform, you guys are the new uniform for national security. That if we don't do this, our concept of being able to continue to be the world's beacon for how societies figure out how to get along with each other and continue a nice positive trajectory of quality of life, that will be in peril. So you guys are on the front lines of this, and I'd like you to think about that as you go forward. Thanks so much for your time and attention today. Great program this day, and really would love to talk to folks at the break. Thank you.
Wonderful. David Simpson, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Great way to kick off.